for inviting me. And I'm going to attempt to bring this conference back on track by giving a very short talk that's almost entirely on numerical methods. So I think we'll, by the end of this, we'll be back on schedule. Well, I'm going to use the blackboard and that. So I have, you know, sort of stuff I'm going to write on the blackboard, and then I have a few movies and, you know, other irrelevant stuff up on that thing.
I'm sure this doesn't describe some kind of superconductor.
Oh, well, in the end it will. I'm going to give a movie at the end, which is, you know, a sort of ultra primitive, you know, sort of caveman version of the stuff that Toby showed us. Basically, this is going to be talk on stuff that I've done with Leo Pandozeis and Dori Reichman. And some of it appears in those two papers, and then other stuff is work in progress. Okay, but basically, the idea is I want to talk about numerical methods. And the idea is the following. Naively, when you think, okay, you know, all of a sudden due to ADS-CFT, it's of interest for, you know, string theory, condensed matter physics, and, you know, six other fields that one could think of to do gravitational collapse. So then you think, well, okay, you know, I've got a gravitational collapse code. Why don't I just go ahead and use that? And then you realize, well, okay, but now they want to do gravitational collapse in ADS. Well, you know, that doesn't sound so bad either. You know, let me just add a negative cosmological constant to my gravitational collapse code and I'm good to go. So the question is, well, okay, you know, is it that simple or are there some obstructions? And if so, what are the obstructions? So let me start, you know, by saying, you know, from a numerical relativity point of view, what's, you know, sort of the first thing that you would try? So the first thing that you would try is exactly the sort of thing that Matt Choptuick taught us all how to do, you know, many years ago when you're looking at gravitational collapse and spherical symmetry. So let me write down what that is. So what, you know, one would try to do is to use what's called polar radial slicing. So you use as your radial coordinate the usual area radius. You use as a time coordinate something that's orthogonal to that. And then you use as the matter some scalar field, which depends on R and T. So the nice thing about the equations that you get from a metric in this form is that for the scalar field phi, you're basically just solving the wave equation. And the only difference between it and the flat space wave equation is that you have these alphas and a's in funny places. And that really doesn't make very much difference at all to the numerical method. The sort of thing that you would use to solve the flat space wave equation, you can do for something like this. And then alpha and a don't solve evolution equations at all. They're just given by integrals that come from the constraint equations. And so all you have to do is solve the wave equation and do a couple of integrals. You know, everything sounds nice and easy. Okay. So can we take a code which is, you know, just adapted to do plain old gravitational collapse in flat space using this sort of system, throw in the negative cosmological constant, and you know, just have it work? Well, there's a couple of difficulties, and let me mention what they are. Okay, so one is that waves get to infinity in finite time, right? So I can draw a diagram of anti-de Sitter space where this is r equals 0, this is r equals infinity, and what waves do is they, you know, propagate out to infinity, propagate back, et cetera, et cetera. But for something like this, what we're going to do is to put r at some finite value, right? I mean, only got a sort of finite computer grid. But in a way, it's the same sort of thing when you do flat space collapse, right? If you wait long enough and you put your maximum value of r at some finite value, waves will cross the grid. You won't be solving the equations exactly, but that's okay. We know what waves do in flat space. They propagate outward across the grid, and we put a boundary condition that says that. And we know what waves do in ADS. What they do is that phi basically goes to zero. So the idea is you can choose, you know, some R max, and now you just set phi equal to zero there. And that's not exactly at R equals infinity, but, you know, for the purposes of the equation, it should be pretty close. Okay, so now let me mention the other problem that has to do with what's called the Courant condition. So the basic idea is that for a numerical code to be stable, you can't take time steps that are too big. And in physical terms, the physical time step has to be smaller than the physical space step. So in flat space, when alpha and a are fairly close to 1, that basically means, you know, delta t has to be less than or equal to delta r. But now let's see what that turns into in ADS. So forgetting for a moment the effect of the scalar field, in ADS, what we have is that alpha squared is 1 plus r squared, a squared is 1 plus r squared to the minus 1. So what this equation says is that alpha dt, that's the physical amount of proper time that you undergo, has to be less than a dr. And so so now what I find dividing through by alpha is that dt has to be less than dr over 1 plus r squared. Okay? So this sounds disastrous, right? I make, you know, my r max something very large, and that forces me to take really, really tiny time steps, and even though it's a 1 plus 1 code, it takes a sort of enormous amount of time for the code to run. But it turns out that this is also something that you can fix. Okay, because there's nothing that says that dr has to be uniform. You don't need to choose a uniform grid. So you can choose a spatial grid where you have, you know, sort of a whole bunch of points near r equals 0, and then you just make your points further and further spaced apart as you get towards the maximum. And it's perfectly simple to write a finite difference code with sort of unequal drs. And so you just make the drs big when r gets big, and then your code can run at a reasonable rate. Okay, so I think I mostly said all this. Using 5 dimensions instead of 4, that's not really that much of a difference as far as these codes go. Signals get to infinity in finite time. We have to, we'll put some boundary at r max, fix phi equals 0 there, use unequal spacing to get things so that the time step can be reasonable size. But this is the whole point, right? I mean, it's exactly a property of ADS that the wave packets spread out as they go towards the boundary in exactly this way. So you don't lose any resolution at all. And that will also become clear later on when I talk about rescaled coordinates. So in fact, if you choose the resolution to be, you know, something that makes this time step a reasonable size, you'll find that when you look at what wave packets do in ADS, that in fact you have, you know, about the same number of grid points per wave cycle, you know, out here as you did there. So you don't lose resolution in any practical sense at all.
Why don't you just compactify your...
Yeah, I'll talk about that later. Right, right. So this is a talk on methods. So the idea is let's think of all the different things that we can do, and what do we have to do to beat on them to get them to work. Okay. So I'm starting with this method because this is a tried and true method in numerical relativity. And so the first sort of instinct is to say, fine, you know, let me haul out my old code and change a few lines here and there and make it work on this new problem. So I will talk a little bit later on in the talk about compactifying and how one deals with that. That has problems of its own, but they are also curable. Yeah,
but
Luis?
But that method is also tried and true in numerical
relativity. Well, yeah, sort of. Not quite as tried and true, but yeah.
No problem with the characteristics.
Right. Well, I'll talk about that as well. Yeah. So there. As Luis says, there's actually two kinds of compactification. One kind of compactification is compactification using spatial slices, and another kind of compactification is compactification using null slices, and both of those are things that one might try. And I will talk about both of those in the course of this talk. Okay, but in any case, this works. So now let me show you, because Rob insists, movies, right, to sort of lighten the mood. So in particular, this is going to be a movie of this quantity X, which is basically the spatial derivative of the scalar field. So you come up with some ingoing Gaussian wave packet, and you let it go. And it moves inward. And it steepens, and eventually it steepens enough that it forms a black hole. Okay, and this is sort of also partly an answer to your question. I mean, what happens in ADS, if you look closely in sort of these coordinates at the behavior of wave packets in ADS, you find that they get steeper and steeper as they go to smaller and smaller r until you get to r of order 1, and then they don't steepen anymore. And so that's exactly why you can do this but not lose resolution. So with high enough amplitude, things form black holes immediately. With low enough amplitude, they don't form black holes immediately. So this is the same sort of thing with lower amplitude. And now this thing is going to go to R equals 0. And then it's going to bounce. It's still there, even though you can't see it. It's just, you know, lower amplitude, and now it's bouncing, and then it comes back. As Bizon showed us, eventually this thing will form a black hole, although not in the time scale of the simulation. And so then you can do sort of other things with this. You can, you know, try out. So in our case, what we looked at were ingoing Gaussian pulses. You can look to see how things depend on the amplitude of the pulse and how they depend on the width of the pulse. So as you might expect, larger amplitude gives you larger mass of the black hole. There's a kind of funny relation between the width of the Gaussian pulse and the mass of the black hole. But this can actually be understood in terms of the fact that smaller width basically means that you have larger derivatives, and larger derivatives give you larger energy density, and so you can sort of measure stuff this way as well.
Do you keep the mass constant, or you just change delta with the same amplitude?
Yeah. So just pick an amplitude and now vary the width. And then just look to see how the mass of the black hole changes with that constant amplitude. And then finally you can talk about the amount of time that it takes to form a black hole, you know, versus amplitude, and you get something like this. And basically this is just sort of the geometric optics approximation. Basically, what the wave packet does is to propagate inward along more or less ingoing null geodesics. And so the amount of time it'll take to form a black hole is just the amount of time it will take for the wave packet to get to the radius it needs to be in order to be within its event horizon, and then you form a black hole. So no particular surprises here. Yeah? Yes, yeah, on the first bounce, right? These are things that are high enough amplitude for a first bounce formation. Okay, so now you might think, as the discussion has been, you know, over the last couple of days, that, well, okay, fine, these sort of funny, spherical global things are all very well for numerical relativity, but surely, you know, in ADS CFT, we want to go to the Poincaré patch. Okay, so the Poincaré patch things, you know, sort of look pretty similar. You can still write the metric in this form. But now the only difference is that you replace this sphere with this flat space. But there's one other difference as well, which is that if you look at what ADS looks like in these Poincaré coordinates, things sort of look singular at r equals 0, right? This alpha goes like r over l, a goes like l over r. So, you know, what's going on here? Are things really singular? Well, they're not really. What happens is that in the Poincaré patch, r equals 0 is really a couple of null planes. And what these t equals constant surfaces basically do is this. So you never actually sort of get away from this point, which is why, you know, sort of things look singular. But that's OK. So you can still evolve the equations in the usual way. You just have to make sure you don't change anything at r equals 0, because r equals 0 isn't actually evolving. It's just this point. Well, OK, but what do we do about the fact that these things are going singular? Well, that's not so bad either. Just write, use a variation of the so-called puncture method. Namely, write alpha as r over l times something, a as l over r times something else, rewrite the equations in terms of these f and g's, and then everything comes out OK. So you can sort of do things in Poincaré coordinates in this way as well. Yeah?
If you do the puncture method, then you require at that point that f and g equal to 1. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, see, alpha and a are given. Well, it's not exactly a Dirichlet condition. I mean, so the point is that you're still in the sort of system where only the scalar field evolves. Gravity is given by pure constraints, and so what that means is that the equations for alpha and a are just integrals outward in R. So and therefore f and g will be given by integrals in R. So the f equals 1 and g equals 1 at r equals 0 is just a beginning point for the integration outwards. So it's not really a Dirichlet condition, because it's not a field that we're evolving. It's more like a fixed constant of integration. Okay, so anyway, so that works too. So in principle, one can, put in masses for the scalar field, positive or negative. And one of the things that we're in the process of looking at is the question of whether we get, with a mass, type 1 critical collapse. So we're not, we haven't finished this yet, so I can't tell you whether we do or we don't. We're not sure at this point. Oh, yeah. So the idea is the following. In gravitational collapse, you can either get a mass gap. That is, if I look at, say, the amplitude of some scalar field, as a function of the amplitude of the scalar field, you can look at the mass of the black hole. Right, and for a while, the amplitude is too small. You don't get any black holes, and eventually, you do get a black hole. And now, in type 1, you have a mass gap. That is, the first black hole you make has non-zero mass. So that's type 1. And for type 2, for low enough amplitude, you don't make a black hole. And then at the amplitude that you do finally make a black hole, you make one of arbitrarily small mass. Okay, so this is type 2. This is the stuff that was found by Chaptuik. This is type 1. There's some old work by Pat Brady in, you know, No Cosmological Constant, Four Dimensions, where you look at a massive scalar field rather than a massless scalar field. And there he finds that you can get both type 1 collapse and type 2 collapse. So depending on the width of the scalar field pulse and depending on the mass of the scalar field, sometimes when you crank the amplitude, you know, up, you find things turning on at zero black hole mass. And sometimes when you crank the amplitude up, you find that you you get a mass gap.
Why do
you say zero temperature?
Well, I mean zero mass black hole, right? So that would be a zero temperature or
infinite temperature. But this stuff we know already happens.
Sorry, you talk. But you also would expect type one because you can imagine that gap can be sufficiently small compared to the ADS length scale.
Right. That's what we would expect. But we haven't found it yet, which is kind of surprising.
Well, okay, my statement was about large black holes in ADS, large on the scale of their curvature.
But as Luis points out, it would be most likely to find these in small scale. See, for both type 1 and type 2 collapse, I mean, the place you would want to look for them is to say, well, we know what happens in flat space. If we can get things at a length scale where the cosmological constant is irrelevant, then we should expect to see similar things to what we see in flat space. I don't know whether, you know, any of these things happen, for large mass black holes, but it's likely that they happen for small mass black holes.
Right. But then for small ADS, with all its complexity and the boundaries, becomes sort of irrelevant, right?
That's what we would expect, yeah.
So is there any type of critical behavior as you approach the discontinuity in type 1?
The critical behavior basically has to do with the time scale for the perturbation, but it doesn't have anything to do with the mass, right? I mean, the mass is just sort of fixed by the mass gap.
Right, but I was thinking about the approach to that one, like a power law in the amplitude.
As you approach the let's see. Yeah, I mean, as you approach the critical solution, the time to black hole formation will go like, I think, some power law. But the mass of the black hole does not have any power law behavior. It's just fixed by the mass gap. Okay, so now I want to address a question that was asked earlier. Well, you know, since R is going to infinity and things get to R in finite time, you know, why don't we just compactify? So you can do that. And let me explain one approach to do that, which is, you know, sort of the Bison approach.
This
is ongoing, but we don't know what we're doing, so we're trying a whole bunch of different numerical methods, and in the context of what numerical methods might work, that's what I'm going on to next. This is still mostly a methods talk.
No, but the question is where your intuition is, because you think. think you're not finding it because of not being able to go all the way to infinity, or you're just trying a different technique just to see if
you... Yeah, both.
Okay.
Basically both, right? I mean, this is sort of an interesting technique, and it might help us get a better handle on this. Is there type 1 collapse? Yeah.
So if you think the initial data that you know in flat space will form a type 1, will give you type 1 behavior.
Yeah.
Can you not take this data? This will have some pulse, some initial pulse of the some shell of the scalar field. And now imagine that you put this in an ADS space that's a million times bigger than that scale, right?
Yeah.
So it's essentially an initial data on a tiny little batch of ADS, which doesn't know it's in ADS.
Yeah.
Why doesn't it?
Well, that's the strategy. I mean, one difference, my guess, is that the Brady stuff is in four dimensions rather than in five dimensions, and so for a while we just said, well, you know, let's just sort of look and see, you know, are we finding type one collapse, and when we weren't, you know, then the notion is, well, okay, let's see what happens in, you know, 4D with a cosmological constant and in 5D without a cosmological constant. So we're not quite sure whether, you know, it's our method isn't good enough, we're looking in the wrong region of parameter space, there's a difference between cosmological constant and no cosmological constant, or there's a difference between 4D and 5D.
Absolutely.
So we're basically trying everything.
In 5D flat space, you don't know yet.
We don't know.
But it's
yeah.
also not quite that simple, I think, because the mass plays the role of setting the scale of this gap.
Right, but
so,
but you
so
can choose
if,
the mass
so choose
that way
mass,
also.
Yeah. So you would need a very large mass, and to look in a very very weakly curved ADS.
Yeah,
that would be the limit.
That's
interesting
right.
Question: if you have a mass of order the size of the curvature scale, then I think it's far from clear whether.
Right, a mass.
Is probably
so
more
so
interesting.
Yeah, so that's sort of another thing. I mean, if we find type one, then the question is, for what values of the mass is it allowed? And it may very well be that if you make the mass of the order the ADS length scale, that type one goes away. I mean, that's one of the things we want to know.
Can you ever claim that you find type one? Can't I just say, well, you don't find collapse because you didn't wait long enough?
Well. Oh yeah, you don't. Right, so you don't do that. So I mean, so we know from Bizon stuff that in some sense there is no critical collapse in ADS because anything, no matter how small its amplitude, eventually forms a black hole. So if you're going to ask the critical collapse question in ADS, you have to do it the way that Chaptuik and Pretorius did for 3D, which is to ask about prompt collapse. In other words, you know, do you get a black hole on the first pulse? Right. If you get a black hole on the first ingoing pulse, fine. And if not, you know, so when you look to see do I form a black hole or not, the idea is you take an ingoing pulse, you let it go, and if it doesn't form a black hole right then, you count that as a no. Okay. So the definition of critical collapse in some sense changes, because otherwise, as you say, trivially, there would be no such thing as critical collapse in ADS. Yeah, Steve?
What's your initial data? What's your stationary solution? Is it in ADS, or you're using the reflecting boundary condition? Right? You're perturbing for this type one. You start with some oscillating solution, right?
Just a plain old ingoing Gaussian pulse, right? I mean, we just come up with, you know.
You don't start
simple.
With a periodic solution that
no.
you perturb? Or?
No. So the idea with the Brady stuff is, you know, just like with the Chaptuik stuff, right? You don't start with the Chaptuik critical solution. You start with something, and then you know it collapses. Other stuff goes away, and what's left is the.
So you have to be in a regime where it's dominated by the potential energy.
Right.
Mass.
Yeah, that's right.
How do you make sure that you're in that regime?
Well, basically, just you know the way that David suggested, namely, you know, we know what does it in flat space. You know, try something similar in ADS. Right.
Because I'm just wondering, because with the boson stars, in ADS, you don't need a mass to get a boson star, whereas in asymptotically flat, you do. And so I just wonder if that is connected at all in terms of your mass is effectively different in the ADS.
Well, yeah, probably is. But the point is to sort of start with a mass which is sufficiently big that you expect the cosmological constant to be almost irrelevant, and then to change the mass until you get it to a place where the cosmological constant is no longer irrelevant, and see if type one goes away.
It would be very strange that the dimensionality plays a role, at least in the limit.
Yeah.
Because Beeson showed that you would have critical phenomena, and from critical phenomena in all dimensions.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just that we haven't searched the right part of parameter space yet. But it's early times.
Two points. One is, does saying that you're doing David's strategy mean that you start the pulse way down in the center, or what I would call way down in the center of the area? Or
I mean that if you wanted to do it exactly, as close as possible to flat space. You probably would start it at R of order one or less, because otherwise it's not, like the corresponding flat space case. Yeah.
No, but aren't you? Well, there was some comment about you needed the potential to dominate. I just imagine that if you start near R max, you're going to get a huge amount of kinetic energy, like you're rolling down the
ADS
potential. So
right,
you have to fight that somehow.
Yeah, I agree. So if one wanted to apply David's strategy, then one would not start near R max. One would start near R equals one or less.
Can I also, when you write M black hole, that's just a cartoon, and you're really looking for an apparent horizon? Is that,
yes. Yeah. It's really radius of the apparent horizon.
Sorry, yeah. One more question. So
okay.
You're not seeing type one. Are you seeing what would look like type two? The AMR.
Well, I mean, so we don't have AMR, so we're seeing very crude versions of type two, but it's just a 1+1 problem, so we can throw lots of points at it. So we do see type two. We don't yet see type one, but most likely because we're not looking in the right region of parameter space. Okay, so now let me go on to this question of well, what about compactive? So here's the Beeson compactification method. We introduce a coordinate x where the area radius r is tan x. And so that means x goes from 0 to pi over 2. So now we have a nice simple grid, right? This is x equals 0. This is x equals pi over 2. And now we can cover that with a uniform grid. Everything should be nice. Okay, so let me explain why everything is not necessarily so nice, but why it's nonetheless possible to get around this.
Why do you think this can help at all in the type 2, the type 1 search? Because, this, you're looking for a prompt case, so you don't need a bound. So the boundary shouldn't be playing any role. So why do you think this can help at all?
There's still this issue, even with the sort of non-uniform grid of sort of how fast the code runs. And so mostly the idea, and also, sort of where exactly you place the outer boundary, is that affecting anything? So this is just to make a couple of things easier, not because we think we absolutely need this. Right. This is more sort of curiosity driven than anything else. Well, how does a method like this work? Will it help us any? Not because we think type one couldn't be found with the other method, but just because this is sort of a neat thing to try. Yeah.
I was just wondering, is it obvious how you define comp collapse? I mean, it's obvious when you've got a sufficiently thin sort of Gaussian shell. You're dialing the amplitude, and of course you just say comp collapse is when the energies reach the center and pass through. I mean, maybe you look at the maximum of the waveform when that reaches the center.
Yeah.
But if I'm a critical phenomena, I should be able to take any wave packet I like and then dial, say, its amplitude.
Yeah.
If I took a more complicated thing with multiple peaks and then talked about dialect amplitude, would it be obvious when is the prompt collapse? How would you?
I don't think there is any general definition. Yeah, I mean there's a rough and ready definition for it. Yeah, I don't think there is any general definition.
Really means something, and I don't know whether it means. I mean, if it's just a property of Gaussian wave, you know, appropriately close to Gaussian wave packets, or whether it's something more general about.
No, here the other thing you're trying to say is that the fact that you have put things in a box are not crucial for the black hole to form.
I think ultimately, critical behavior is just. It's a local behavior around a fixed point or an unstable fixed point, or you know, and so this Bizon instability is just yet another instability, and so it affects things. But it's, you know, critical behavior is just around that.
Well, type two critical behavior is. So yeah, I mean, I think so. The point is that because the Chaptuhak critical solution is local, you can at least recognize if you're finding something like that. The type one stuff might be a little bit trickier, but even then, right? I mean,
so
we'll just
sense,
we just have a rough and ready notion of prompt collapse. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and even the type one, I mean, you get some stationary or static or some kind of periodic solution, and then you look
right
around that, and it all boils down to, you know, and so then, yeah, you can throw another instability.
Yeah. So let's talk about what happens if you compactify in this way. So then you can write the metric in this form. Okay, so now it's the same sort of thing. Now you just have a wave equation in T and X for the scalar field, and you have constraint equations that give you integrals that allow you to figure out these metric components A and delta. You write a code and you do this, but you run into a difficulty, and let me explain what that difficulty is. Okay, so let's look at the behavior near x equals pi over 2. What you can show is that if we define rho to be pi over 2 minus x, so in other words, how close you are to this boundary at infinity, then you can show that the scalar field will go like rho cubed. And that doesn't sound bad, but from the point of view of numerics and the point of view of doing finite difference codes, what you get to do at a boundary is you get to impose one condition. So the thing to remember is that what this says is that at the boundary, phi vanishes, the derivative of phi vanishes, and the second derivative of phi vanishes. So in other words, three conditions that you have to impose. And, you could impose one of them, but how are you going to get the other two? So apparently, Steve has some sneaky tricks to do this. What's that?
If it's only one condition.
Analytically, it's one condition. Numerically, you have to ensure these three things.
But doesn't this mean that you should just work with phi over rho squared?
So I'm going to get to that.
I mean, where it's harder is when you want to turn on the normal level and the normal.
Okay. So it's almost exactly what you said. Okay, so in these codes, it's often easier to sort of write everything in first order form and to define the spatial and time derivatives of the field as the variables you evolve. But it's also helpful, especially if you're going to put in a mass, to have the field itself as one of the variables. So it turns out that one of the easiest things to do is to define this field to be the actual scale of the field itself divided by cos squared x. So now I've gotten rid of two of these three powers of rho, and now the condition that I have is just that psi vanish at the outer boundary. So that's an easy thing to impose. I just set it to be equal to 0 at the last grid point. And in terms of the spatial derivative and time derivative, I can define s to be the spatial derivative, again, with this one extra power. And now it's the derivative of s that has to vanish. And similarly, p will be the time derivative of phi, again, with these extra powers of cosine x. And then p is going to vanish as well. Okay, so.
So actually, if you have a source as well for that,
yeah.
Then what you I think have to do, what I was doing, in the talk is you separate out the source analytically because that's something you want to fix.
Yeah.
And you would have a psi naught plus your phi over cos squared x.
I think that's right. Or you would have to do it as the bound. Yeah.
But you just think you want to take it out analytically.
And what we have done in some cases, so you definitely take it out analytically. Then you see what comes next. And that example we evolve cube. So you might choose to do one of two things. One is to take the raw cube out and then have a particular like a Neumann condition or something for what is left. Or you take just only rho square and then you have a Dirichlet condition at zero. So you fix it at zero, but you don't restrict it.
Yeah.
So when either option seems to be depending on the application better.
So now, in order to satisfy Rob's insatiable need for movies, I'm going to show another one. So this is rescaled scalar field psi, so basically the scalar field divided by cosine squared x. And now, because we have this divided by cosine squared x, this thing is not going to fall off so fast. And so this is x equals 0. This is going to be x equals pi over 2, which is r equals infinity. And the thing will bounce back and forth until it forms a black hole or the code runs out of time. So there it is. It's going off to infinity. We impose the boundary condition that it vanishes, just like holding a string at the end. And then it goes back. And now it's become steep enough that it's formed a black hole. So basically, this sort of Bison type compactification works fine. But to get a finite difference code to work, you either have to beat on it really cleverly, the way Steve does, or you have to rescale things in this way. And either of those work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you integrate ODEs for A and for delta. But you just set A equals 1 and delta equals 0 at R equals 0, and you just integrate those outward. So there's no there's no issue of stability there, right? I mean, you just get whatever the integrals give you.
David, two questions. Yeah. One, what order is this at? And two, is this ADS 5?
This one is ADS 4.
Okay, have you tried 5? Because I noticed a big difference.
I haven't tried 5, but I think it should work just as well in 5.
And is this second order?
Yeah, it's a second order code. You know, the simplest thing that you can imagine, standard center differences and iterated Crank-Nicholson. The only thing that's a little bit tricky is that near the origin, right, I mean, you have this sort of, you know, usual 1 over R squared, and then you use the, you know, sort of Evans slash Chaptuik method with the sort of, you know, 1 over R plus cubed, 1 over 1 over minus 1 R minus cubed. To make that regular. And interestingly enough, what you find is at infinity, you have exactly that same structure, and you finite difference it in exactly the same way. So both infinity and R equals 0 act like origins in exactly this way. And you do the sort of standard finite differencing that you use for an origin to make it regular. So I'm pretty sure it should work just as well in ADS 5 as it does in ADS 4, but I'll try it out and see. You're worried that ADS 5 is going to be nastier in some sense?
Well, I had things working in ADS 4, and then I changed it to 5, and it didn't. You know, it was very unstable at the outer boundaries, so then I had to sort of beat on it more, in your words.
Ah, okay, but now it works. Huh?
It works.
But
okay.
Now it's getting,
yeah, the stuff that gets faster.
I mean, in this approach, I don't think it'll make any difference, but if you're not taking out the leaving powers, then
right. Yeah, but it would just be interesting just to make sure.
Yeah. So anyway, I recommend this, you know, not because it's strictly necessary, because, you know, Steve has a working code that doesn't use this, but because it's simpler, right? I mean, I think it's probably, you know, a little bit more straightforward to just, you know, take out the appropriate powers, finite difference in the usual way, and it basically sort of works out of the box. But I will try ADS 5, and we'll see if that works as well.
But if you want to extract these boundary constants, if you're interested in ADS-DFT, then I think this is essential, because then the gradient of phi, your little phi there, is going to give you the VEV of whatever the operator
this,
is.
This thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
No, just d phi dx.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay.
It's going to give you the gradient, whereas if you don't take out the powers, any small numerical noise is going to make extracting the VEVs very hard.
Possibly. I should mention, by the way, that my guess is that Bizon does something like this, but he has almost no description of his numerical methods in the paper, so I don't know. I mean, so maybe he's doing something like what Steve is doing. But anyway, so these are sort of two ways I know to make this work. And this one does as well. Okay, so now let me mention a sort of variation on this that I'm only in the preliminary stage of trying out, but I think it might be quite useful. Okay, so one sort of disadvantage of the metric in this Bizon form, and also of the metric in the original Chaptuik form, is that because you're using the area radius as one of your coordinates, the evolution can only last as long as the area radius remains a space-like coordinate. Well, that doesn't sound so bad until you remember that as soon as you form an apparent horizon, the area radius becomes null. So what that means is that when you study black hole formation using the Chaptuik style coordinates or Bizon's variation on them, your evolution must stop as soon as you form a black hole. And in fact, you only, in some sense, infer the formation of a black hole by saying, okay, you know, this metric component is blowing up and at this spatial point, and therefore I am forming a black hole right at this point. So suppose you want to take the evolution a little bit longer, and also suppose you want a code where you don't have to say, you know, where you can actually say a black hole has formed because this quantity is going to zero, rather than a black hole is forming because, you know, metric components are blowing up. So then you might want to, you know, do something slightly different. And also, this sort of way of regularizing the boundary seems to use things that are, you know, special to spherical symmetry. And so one of the things we might like is a method that, you know, has more of a fighting chance to generalize beyond spherical symmetry. Now, again, that's not strictly necessary, right? Franz Pretorius has a code using harmonic coordinates that, you know, does just fine. But again, you have to, you know, sort of beat on it with lots of clever techniques to keep things regular. So I want to suggest a method that might, you know, have sort of a slightly easier time of keeping things regular. So let me write down what things look like. Okay, so this looks almost like the previous metric, except now instead of tan squared x, I have this funny e to the a tan squared x, and now I have an e to the minus 2a multiplying the dx squared, and then here I have this alpha tilde squared, which I haven't, you know, yet described. So let me explain what conditions one uses here. So the idea is the following. The reason for this funny e to the minus 2a and e to the a here is that when you take the determinant of the spatial metric, you get something that has no dependence on a. It's just a strict, you know, function of sines and cosines of x. The alpha we're going to choose using maximal slices, right? We're going to make sure that each slice of constant time has a trace of the extrinsic curvature equal to zero. When you do that, and when you use no shift vector, it then follows that the determinant of the spatial metric is something that's constant. So the nice thing about this, from the point of view of, you know, seeing after black hole formation, is that maximal slices do penetrate the horizon. They don't end when you form a black hole. So you can follow the evolution a bit further. The nice thing about the sort of fixed determinant and zero shift is that if you look near the boundary in ADS, then the observers that are orthogonal to the slice, those are the ones that basically stay in the boundary. So what that means is that if you have initial data where things fall off in the appropriate way, and then you evolve them, they will continue to fall off in the appropriate way. So Even though this isn't much of an advantage in spherical symmetry, if you could do this more generally, it might make it easier for things to satisfy the necessary Fefferman-Graham fall-off conditions. All you would need is to make the initial data satisfy that, and then they would continue to satisfy it as you evolve.
The horizon is sitting at alpha equals zero?
No. No. So the horizon is sitting wherever this quantity goes null, right? So that's a condition, and then you can just check that condition during the evolution. This one. Okay, right, because this is the area radius. So wherever the area radius goes null, that's where you find a horizon. So the idea is that as the code runs, at any time you can check, you know, do I have a place where this thing has gone null? And when it does, you found a trapped surface, but the evolution doesn't stop there. You just keep going.
Do you want that going to zero, or the derivative of that going null?
Oh, well, it's the same thing, right? So the claim is, for the area radius r, right, the idea, as you say, is that the expansion is basically proportional to LA grad AR, right? So LA grad AR has to be zero. That's the condition for a trapped surface. But in spherical symmetry, LA can only point in the RT plane. So if LA grad R is equal to zero and L is a null vector, then grad R has to be a null vector. In spherical symmetry, the easy way to find a trapped surface is to just say grad R is null. Whatever your form of the metric, as long as you have spherical symmetry, you just have to check that GAB grad AR grad BR is equal to zero. That is the condition for a trapped surface. So in this particular case, R is e to the a over 2 tan x. And so you just write out in a metric of this form, what do I need in order for this equation to be satisfied? And that's your condition for I've formed a trapped surface.
Yeah, so the way I was thinking is if I fix theta phi of my angles, then I'm looking for an L rate. So I just see from there it's a combination of e to the minus 2a divided by alpha. And I have both signs plus minus, right? And so then this one has to be going faster outwards for. My cones would have been tilted with respect to the now, well, with respect to your horizon rate.
I don't think it can quite be that simple because this condition also involves derivatives of A.
No, I'm not looking at that. So let's say you have it at some point.
Yeah.
Then I just take all my angles constant. So then I'm looking at the now constructor I would have if I'm approaching along X.
Yeah.
And I see that I have both positive and negative.
Uh-huh.
So I have a cone that still is. So that means my horizon is constantly departing outwards at a faster rate for it to be inside of that code.
I don't think it's quite that simple, but we should talk about it a little bit more. I mean, mathematically, it has to be equivalent to this, whatever the condition is.
I don't have any problem with that. I'm just trying to picture how this grid is going to look like. And aren't you going to end up having a horizon that basically is going really fast out and you're going to eat up your whole space?
Eventually you will get grid stretching. That's right. So either with a maximal slicing code, you have to sort of add a bunch of extra points to maintain resolution, or you just say, well, okay, I'm not going to run the code forever, or you excise somewhere or something. So the point is this is not really a prescription for a code that runs forever, but this is a prescription for a code that will run longer than it takes to form a trapped surface.
Sorry,
what,
can you explain again?
Can you
translate what Lewis said?
I don't think I would even attempt that. I don't think Argentinian.
No, but honestly, so he's saying that the horizon is going to expand somehow and begin to
Okay, yeah, so let me, right, so that part at least I can translate. So so let's consider the usual, you know, sort of Schwarzschild, you know, with the horizon. So what we're supposed to do, in fact, actually, let me write one of these sort of old-fashioned diagrams where, you know, sort of the singularity looks like this and the horizon looks like this. So the time slice is going to penetrate inside the horizon, okay? But it's not going to hit the singularity, right? Because in a numerical evolution, if your slice hits the singularity, that's game over. And one of the nice things about maximal slices is they don't hit the singularity. Okay, but what that means is that in some sense, the slices get hung up, right? So later and later slices are going to sort of pile up, you know, right around here. But out here, later and later slices are going sort of at the usual rate. And so what that means is that the slices pile up near the horizon. So this is actually a sort of numerical relativist version of the stretched horizon that you know, all the particle physicists like, right? You make a stretched horizon in this way. But because a stretched horizon is almost null, what that means is that it requires a sort of large number of grid points to cover a sort of small amount of space. And so what happens is that either, you know, you sort of lose resolution or you add grid points. I mean, so that's the basic idea. And this is a sort of well-known phenomenon in numerical relativity called grid stretching, and people sort of worried about this for a while before excision, right? I mean, so the notion was, you know, gee, what are we going to do? You know, we could use maximal slicing, but our slices are going to pile up. We're going to lose resolution, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the thing for which excision is the usual cure, and one could try that here as well. But anyway, I'm not claiming this as something that one should use for everything. It's just that it will run a little bit longer than these other things.
The maximal slicing condition is what? Is it vanishing
extrinsic curvature? Vanishing trace of the extrinsic curvature. Yeah.
So it's just one of the constant mean curvature.
Yes, exactly. It's a constant mean curve. Right. Well, it's a zero mean curvature slice, right? I mean, and that's important because zero mean curvature slices go to spatial infinity, but constant mean curvature slices with trace k not equal zero go to null infinity. So you wouldn't want one of those, at least not in a usual Cauchy code. Okay. So now. Since I've already broken my promise to keep to a reasonable amount of time, I'm going to, I'm going to talk briefly about the stuff that Toby talked about, and one last method, which involves null coordinates. Okay, so another way to compactify is to just say, okay, well, you know, r is going to infinity, fine, let me introduce this coordinate w, which is 1 over r, so at ADS infinity, that's just going to be 0, and let me introduce another coordinate v, which is basically just going to be the ADS time at infinity and is going to be constant along null rays. So now, things look like this. So this is ADS infinity, which is really W is equal to 0. And now our slices of constant time look like this. And so now how do we sort of evolve something like this? Well, one thing we can do is the method that Toby uses, which is, and also that Paul Chesler uses, which is to go ahead and do a sort of spectral method where everything gets expanded in Chebyshev polynomials, and you use that expansion to evolve to the next slice. But one is not forced to do that. I mean, that's a way of doing things. In particular, one can use finite difference methods, which I think Luis and Alex are using. Is that right? Yeah, okay. So basically, the idea with the finite difference methods is the following.
You're right, you use a different code.
What's that? Oh, okay. Oh, and Rob, I'm sorry, and Rob. Right. Sorry, Luis, Alex, and Rob. Okay, so the basic idea is that here at W equals zero, ADS infinity, fix the behavior of the field, right? So this is the stimulus that you put in. And now you assume at the beginning that you basically have nothing, right? I mean, so nothing happens, you know, before the stimulus. That is, no scalar field and neither, a pre-existing black hole or plain old ADS or something like that. And then you need to evolve to the next slice. So if you don't want to use Chebyshev polynomials and you do want to use finite differences, basically you can use what's called a marching algorithm. So the basic idea is, we know what's going on at this point. We know what's going on everywhere on this slice. We have a finite difference stencil. And in particular, there's a very beautiful general purpose finite difference stencil for this method that I found in an old paper of Luis Lehner, Jeff Winokur. Let's see, is Gomez an author on that paper too?
The initial work was Wedding, Winokur, and Gomez.
I see. Okay. Anyway, and for that reason, I'm going to call it the Lehner stencil. Anyway, one can use the Lehner stencil, and the point is that having written the finite difference equations in this way, what you find is that if you know what's going on at this point, and you know what's going on at all of these points, then a little bit of algebra tells you what's going on at this point, but now you know what's going on at this point, and you know what's going on at these points, and so a little algebra gives you this one, and then so on, and you sort of march up, and now you know what's going on at this slice, and you go on at this slice, and so on.
I mean, isn't this is like double null as well?
Yeah, it's
I mean, it's the same.
The diamond algorithm.
Yeah.
So
in double null, you're marching with these. Double null, you give no preference to go.
Yeah, you could go either way. Right?
This one you say I'm going to go for
sure. But I mean the stencil.
It's exactly the same.
Okay, so once again, satisfying Rob's insatiable need for movies, I'm going to show you one last movie.
I think you need movies in one plus one.
So this is also. This is also going to be one of these sort of ADS type things. Only so now I've written so now this is basically going to be a pre-existing charged black hole. This line is going to be the horizon of the black hole. We're going to be going outward in R, despite the fact that the coordinates we do in the evolution are really 1 over R, and not all the way to R equals infinity, just to some maximum value. The evolution itself goes all the way to infinity, but I'm just displaying up to some large but finite value. And what we're going to do is we're going to tweak the scalar field at infinity to be a hyperbolic tangent. So in other words, phi at infinity as a function of time is basically going to look like this. And then we're going to get some response that goes all the way to the horizon. And you shouldn't be surprised, since these are null coordinates, responses basically propagate immediately. And so this will be a movie of, if at infinity the scalar field goes like a tanch, what does it do between infinity and the horizon? So first, not very much happens because the tanch is way down here. Eventually, right, it's picking up. And as you see, things sort of immediately propagate to the horizon because these are null coordinates. And eventually, at infinity, it will settle down at the other end, and the horizon will follow suit as well.
Is this a charged skeleton or is this a neutral skeleton?
So in this particular case, we're only looking at a neutral scalar field, but we're just sort of doing this as a toy problem for now. But it's very easy to put in the charge, which we'll do next.
When you're talking about charge scalar field, do you mean a global charge, or you also mean that you have a gauge field in the bulk as well?
So this is just a test scalar field. So the idea is there's a charged black hole which has its own vector potential, and
right,
the scalar field obeys gauge covariant derivative, et cetera, et cetera.
Sorry. So you're not evolving the metric.
No. This is just a test scalar field.
I see.
Yeah. This is just a simple test problem. But this is just a sort of toy problem test of the method. I mean, once this works, I don't think there's much of an obstruction to putting in the metric stuff as well. So I expect this to work fine in the general case. But all we've done so far is this test case. Yeah, I know. So Alex is smiling because there are always problems. But nonetheless, I mean, I think this will generalize pretty easily.
Yeah. But if you want to go to higher order or look at tremendously fast punches, you might be facing
something. Yeah, okay. Well, if and when that happens, I'll ask you for advice. But anyway, so now let me conclude. So basically, as you all know, I don't really have to remind you, numerics is starting to tell us a few things about ADS collapse. And what I want to emphasize in this talk is that the kind of numerics that you need depends on which questions you're asking, and that there's a lot of sort of stuff that numerical relativists already know that can be used, but it has to be adapted to the problem at hand. Okay, so that's it. Thank you.